day, my friends, and welcome to the Craig Shapiro Tennis Podcast. Today's show is brought to you by the legendary Sergio Tacchini, brand worn by John McEnroe, Vitas Gerulaitis, Novak Djokovic, and Gabriella Sabatini. Check them out at sergiotacchini.com. Diadora, the brand made famous by Bjorn Borg and currently worn by world number 28, Alejandro Davidovich Fokina, is the official shoe of the podcast. See them at Diadora.com. We have a very special show for you today. Today's guest was born in Savannah, Georgia in 1938 and moved to Bethesda, Maryland when he was an infant. He was a player. He was an attorney. He was the winning captain of the U.S. Davis Cup team in 1968 and 1969 and has the distinction of being the first tennis agent, period. He also has the distinction of being instrumental in the creation of the ATP and negotiated arguably the two most significant shoe deals in history. In 2009, he was inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Donald Dell is today's guest. We're going now. Hang on. Where are you? Are you in D.C.?
Yeah, I'm in my home in Potomac, Maryland.
Potomac. And you've been in D.C. for many, many years, I understand.
All my life.
Oh, but you were born in Savannah, Georgia.
Right. Exactly. But I left there when I was 3 months old.
So you're a D.C. man.
Yeah.
Now, is Ben's Chili Bowl still the real thing? Do people eat? Will you eat that?
Oh, yeah. It's very big at it's very big downtown, very big at the stadium, the baseball stadium. It's very popular.
What do you get if you go there? What will you have? Will you have the half smoke?
I'll have the chili. I love the chili and I love the sausage. Yeah, both.
Gentlemen, you hear with, I think they call that a dulcet voice, a very smooth voice. He was a player. He has the distinction of being really the first agent. One of the first agents in all of tennis and really all of sports. He's done massive things in the sport, essentially creating pro tennis. That's Donald Dell. Do I have all that right? Was that a fair assessment?
I think it was pretty good. Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. This is an honor. What's happening in DC for you? We're getting ready for Thanksgiving.
Well, I have twin daughters and they have two grandchildren. They're all coming down. They're all living in New York, and they're all coming down for Thanksgiving. So we're looking forward to it.
Is weather an issue? Is everyone going to make it out of there all right?
Well, you know, it's been really warm here until suddenly in the last week. It now is now 39, 40 degrees. It's much colder. It just turned on a dime. It was very warm a week ago.
As you know, we do a 5-set format. The first set is the off-the-court report. Well, you said it first. 1 week ago, I introduced myself to you. We were in New York City for the premiere of the Stan Smith documentary that LeBron James's company, Spring Hill, did. What were your impressions?
Well, I thought it was really quite interesting. They did capture the spirit and character of Stan Smith, I thought, excellently. I thought it was very... I thought he did the director Danny Lee. I thought did a very good job with what he had to work with, and I thought it came across as a really good, outstanding story of Stan Smith's life and different parts of his life, like the Adidas shoe and other aspects, the Wimbledon boycott. I thought they did a very good job.
And it was a great night for it's funny, you know, we don't get those great nights for tennis in New York in the fall the way we once did. That was a nice night for tennis, wasn't it?
Yeah, it sure was. Everybody was there. All of Stan's four children were there, and an awful lot of people who love tennis were there.
Now, they call you Donald Deal. Now, is it true that you were making deals at the after party there? Did you have anything going on over there or no?
No, I'm just trying to get a drink. I wouldn't make any deals.
Let's move into the second set. This is the On the Court report. Just a day ago, we learned that the ATP – has increased prize money with some real significance. Do you still have your fingers on the pulse of pro tennis?
I'm still fairly involved, yeah, on a regular basis. I talk to the ATP. I talked to Wimbledon today about some stuff. I stay very involved, yeah.
Can you speak to the prize money increase? What happened there? How did that happen? What the significance is?
I don't know what exactly the total amounts were, but what the strategy was and what they were planning to do was they weren't going to do anything for 23 because it was on them when they it was so late they didn't decide. And then 24 is an Olympic year, which really screws up the schedule of players. It really makes it maybe 1 or 2 weeks less. So starting in 25, my understanding is they're going to increase the 1,000 series event, maybe up to 20, 25 million per tournament, and extend them to 12 days a week, right? a 2 week tournament in Toronto and Cincinnati, and
Rome,
most of the
Rome, yeah, Rome Madrid.
Yeah. They're going to try to make them really more like mini slams. They're trying to compete, I think, and lessen the divergency there between the Grand Slams and the ATP thousands. That's what's, I think, ultimately all about.
Do you have a fluid relationship with Gaudenzi and Massimo Cavalli?
I have a very good relationship with Massimo Cavalli. I'm not close to Gaudenzi. I just don't know him well. But I think they're both very capable of what they're doing.
Are you in favor of the leadership? Do you think that they're moving in a good direction?
I'm very much in favor of what they've done to date in some areas. For example, they're revamping the whole council and the voting on the council. And they're also revamping, getting rid of all the conflicts of interest in the sport. So that if you're on that council, if you're representing players, or you're representing tournaments, you can't have any conflicts of interest in the sport. And that's a major breakthrough, in my opinion. Very important.
Where have they not done well?
Well, I think the problem is always communication. The strength, you know, if you really looked at all the players associations in sports, what is the best one? The best players association historically has always been baseball. Why is that? Because baseball, when Miller started it and his disciples followed, they really did one great thing. They communicated regularly every week with their clientele, with their clients. And the baseball players, whether you like them or not like them, they're really educated. And I think NFL football has tried to catch up, but they're way behind. They're not really – the players are not as informed. And that's – you know, if you inform a group of players, that's very important. And I think the previous administrations and the ATP council have not done a good job of communicating what it is to the players themselves. They're getting it all second and third hand from other participants who have an axe to grind in the sport.
Your impressions and understanding of the machinations of the PTPA.
Well, I think Djokovic got tired of the men's pro council and sort of tried to splinter group. And my position has always been the new players association would do well to really, rather than trying to have a competitive situation, have a complementary one, which is to try and make it better by using them not as at a battering ram. I mean, it's going to hurt the whole structure if you come in and try to fight them. And I think the ATP is too strong and too broad and too wealthy that they won't beat them head to head. So they should come in and try to get things done on the grounds of prize money, conflicts of interest, scheduling, points, things that are important to players. They could really represent and do a good job for.
Are you concerned that a live golf situation is on the horizon?
I'm not concerned about that, although I think some of the people in the sport are, and I think that's one of the other unspoken reasons that they raised the prize money so much in the Master Series. I think that was very deliberate, just as golf and the PGA has done. And I think if you go from, you know, a Master Series tournament that's putting up $8 or $10 million in prize money, you suddenly go to 25. That's a phenomenal increase in 1 or 2 short years. So they've got to give them time to get ready with sponsors to do that. That's why they're waiting to start in 25, among other reasons.
Are you plugged into the women's tennis the same way you are to the men's?
I wouldn't say I'm as close to the women, although I do follow them. And Billie Jean King is a personal friend. And the lady Simon, who runs it head of it, the man is, a good friend.
Steve Simon.
Yeah, Neil, you know, he's really, I think, done a very quiet good job for them in a lot of ways. And the president, the lady president, I've known for a number of years, and speak with her, you know, from time to time. I think they've come a long way in a short distance in the last year or two. And their goal is to somehow merge. First of all, try to get parity with the men, and then also merge with the the ATP. That's what the WTA, their goal is, to merge.
What is your opinion of the health of their association at the moment?
I think at the moment it's gotten much stronger than it was, say, a year or two ago. I think they found some investors to help insist. I think they took a very strong stand against China over one of their players, you know, over there in China. And they lost 9 events in one fell swoop in China when they pulled out. Well, that takes terrific guts. And it also set them back a couple of years financially. So I think they made great recovery from those days, which was a year ago.
Davis Cup, the Masters, they call it the finals now. The Nitto Finals is just about to finish. And then we're going to have 2 weeks of Davis Cup. You're a former Davis Cup captain. Your opinion of what's happened to Davis Cup?
Well, sadly, my opinion is very negative. I think the Davis Cup, as I know it and loved it and respected it, has been destroyed. I think it's become a 10-day exhibition of 8 countries playing each other. And it's more now for television. But, you know, they've lost the home and home. They've lost the best of 5 sets, the 5-set matches, five events, rather. I mean, it's totally a different format. It's 3 matches, 1, you know, singles and doubles. It's just a totally different, they've lost tradition. They've lost the history of it. And they all did that. Why did they do that? They did it all for one reason. The ITF wanted money, and that was their funding vehicle. So they made a deal with the rich promoter to give them about $1 billion to change everything. And in my opinion, they have destroyed the Davis Cup as I know it.
Let's move into the third set. This is the portion of our show where we talk about your career. You know, there's so much that's been written about you. There's been so much that you've done. But my question to you, I guess, you know, I think the only way to really do it, you start from the beginning. Donald, where does your tennis begin?
Well, I started at the Edgemore Club in Bethesda, Maryland. When I was about 6 years old, we grew up a block from the club. And my mother took me over there, and I started playing very young, 6, 7 years old. But I live literally about 50 yards from the club across the street. And it's not a golf club. It's all tennis and mainly a little swimming. And they had 7 clay courts. And the members of the club, particularly men, I got very good, very young, 7, 8, 9 years old. I was very steady and so forth. And they took a big interest in helping me. And that really changed my whole approach to the sport.
You got good.
Yeah, I did. When I was 13 years old, I was probably number 3 or 4 in the 15s nationally. And when I was 15, you know, I won every tournament that year and was undefeated and was ranked number 1 in the country as a 15-year-old.
And then what?
And then I played the 18s. 3 years later, my group in those days was 15 and 18. Today it's 16 and 18, but I played at 15 and 18. And when I was 18, I again was dominating pretty well on the American side in the Western Junior Champions. I played a young kid named Rodney George Laver in the finals and beat him in 5 sets in a huge long match that we battled out.
You beat Rod Laver in 5 as a junior.
Yeah.
Where?
In Champaign, Illinois at the Western Championships. 2 weeks later, with the national championship.
Wait! What was the score in the 5th? Come on, you can't just brush over that.
I think it was like 6-4, 6-3. It was 6-3 or 6-4, but it was a long, real hot day. We were dying out there, both of us. And he, you know, Rod.
Back then in that's the 50s.
Correct. That would have been
in the 50s.
56.
Rod Laver traveled to the United States to play junior tennis.
Well, he was traveling with the Davis Cup team with Hoden Rosewall, but he was only, you know, 18 years old. We're the same age. Rodney and I happen to be the same age. So I played him unbeknownst to me. And I, you know, I didn't know him. He didn't know me. I barely won that match. But what happened then 2 weeks later, we both went to Kalamazoo for the Nationals. And I was seated number one on the American side. He was seated number one on the foreign side. Today, which I think is a terrible mistake, they don't allow foreigners to play.
Right.
It's only
just
Americans only, which I think stinks. But anyway, Rod and I didn't know many people there. And in the first round, it's funny. He was playing a guy from Kansas City, and he was down about 10 match points. And there was no tiebreaker in the 50s, and it was slow clay. And he finally won the match, and he was walking back to the dorms in the college. I came over to him and walked back with him. And I said, God, that was one hell of a match, Rod. We had become friends, you know, and he's a very outgoing, easygoing guy. And he said, I can't beat these pushers on clay. There's no way. He said, I'm coming in on every ball. I just can't beat him staying on the baseline. So in the semifinals, I got through the semis and he got through. We played in the semifinals. He took my first serve and came in. He took my second serve and came in, and he beat me 4-4 in the semis, and then went on to win the tournament the next day, the championship. And then we were both 18. And at that stage, I then went on to Yale. And when I finished Yale 3 years later, I'd been undefeated there, and I was All American 3 years. You had to play a freshman year. And then I was ranked in the men coming out of Yale, number 24 in the country, which was pretty good for a college kid. And yet Rod Laver, when he came out four years later, was number one in the world.
Now, do you think that going to Yale, do you ever look back? Did you ever look back and say, oh man, maybe I could have like been a contender for Wimbledon or the Italian Open or the French, you know, could I have done very well in pro tennis?
No, it was funny, really and truthfully.
Listen, with all due respect, you got to six in the world. I'm just asking if you going to college.
No, I don't. I didn't regret it, because in America, you know, there's a lot of big pressure to go for education. And my father was really strongly adamant that I take this scholarship and go to college at Yale or anywhere in the Ivy League is where he wanted me to go. And that was fine. When I was playing the circuit, my whole years, you know, those were the days of sort of the paid amateurs, the under the table paid expenses in those days in the 50s and 60s. And so I played the tour about 4 or 5 years while I was still going to law school. If I went to Yale for 4 years, then law school, then I took 2 years off to play the tour. But I learned very quickly that where I was 4, 5, or 6 in the American singles, and I was 1 in the doubles twice, I knew I was never going to be the best player. Now, you got to remember, in 1966, I decided to retire from the tour and go back and practice law with a big law firm. I'd gone to law school 61 to 64 and played for 2 years on the tour, played everybody, went all over the world. But I knew I wasn't the best player. And in 1966, there was no money in the game. None. Zero.
Let me just pause. For our listeners, Donald just mentioned that the players got paid under the table. Now, I have understanding of this because Martin Mulligan is a friend, and he's explained it to me. But basically, the money would go to the federations, and then the federations would duke the players.
That's part of it. But more than that, it was an expensive situation, an expense payment. For example, when you played in the tour in those days, you were housed privately in different homes, and you got meals at clubs and so forth. And so in my case, I was what was called a 200. I would make $200 a week playing. Excessive expenses.
Well, you said you were called something. What were you called?
Well, I was called a 200 expense player. And there was some, you know, Neil Fraser, who was the best player in that. It was 1,000. He was making 1,000 a week. I'm making 200 a week. The number one American, Chuck McKinley or Dennis Ralston, they're making 400, 500, 600 a week. But that was from excessive expenses. And that was just sort of a game everyone played. And there was no prize money. I quit in 66. And lo and behold, in 68, the game goes open. And prize money comes into the sport when Wimbledon and the U.S. Open decide to let the pros play. And so suddenly the game exploded in 68 and 69. I had been practicing law for about a year and a half, and they asked me to be the Davis Cup captain in 1968, which I accepted. And that was a big
thrill. When you say
for me.
They, you mean the United States Lawn Tennis Association.
Well, it was called the United States Tennis Association. They dropped lawn.
They dropped the L, and it was the USTA even then when they – and they named you Davis Cup captain.
In 68, March, yeah.
And that's a huge, prestigious thing.
Yeah, it was really something. I was the youngest captain. I was 29 years old that had ever been appointed. And before I accepted, I went to three – because I had just stopped playing 2 years earlier. I went and saw Charlie Passarell and Arthur Ashe and a couple of them, Bobby Lutz. And I said, look, are you guys serious? I mean, I don't want to quit my job and take the captaincy, which is no money. I was getting paid $28 a day. Room and board per diem. I mean, it was ridiculous. And we had to play. We had lost the Davis Cup 5 years in a row in that time. And we had to win six countries. We played in 1968 to defend it, to win the Davis Cup. We had to win six matches.
Who'd you have to play?
Yeah. Oh, we played British West Indies. We played India. We played Mexico. We played Australia. The biggest match was the finals in Australia when we beat Harry Ottman and the Australians on grass down there 4-1. But then the next year in 69, I stayed on as the captain because under the rules, we were playing, it had a thing called the challenge round. And all the teams played out to see who would play the defending champion. We played the Romanians, Nastase and Tiriac, and we beat them by 5-0 in Cleveland that in 69. And that was like in July or August of 69. And
you guys wiped out. It was so it was Stan, Lutz, Arthur.
It was Stan. It was the team.
Passarell.
The four team was Arthur, Stan, Bobby, Clark Gravener played in some of the matches in Australia. He played singles on grass and did very well. And we really had a 5 or 6 man team, but I had a squad of about 10 players. And suddenly I was faced in December of 69, I'd been undefeated for 2 years. And I saw the game going, professional because the open tennis had come on. Prize money just was starting. And I went back and I took Arthur, my best player, I took Arthur Ashe to see Mark McCormick of IMG four different times to see if he and McCormick would hook up together. And the last time we were driving down the East Side Drive in a cab in New York, and Arthur said to me, how many more times are you going to take me to McCormick? And I said, well, Arthur, I think he's the best one for you to go with. I said, you're going to turn pro. You want to make the most money. He has the Olympic Committee and television. He has Jean-Claude Killy, the skier. And he has three guys named Palmer, Player, and Nicholas in golf. He's pretty damn strong, and that's really what you ought to do. And Arthur turned, looked at me and said, wait a minute. He said, why don't you do it? And I said, why don't I do what? And he said, why don't you be my manager and my lawyer and take care of my affairs? I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going back to law firm in Washington. I want to be a Clarence Darrow. I want to be a trial lawyer. That's what I've always wanted to do, and that's what I'm going to do. And he said, well, if you thought about it and you decided to do it, Stan would join us and we could start a business. And that was the germ that started it all was his suggestion. I wouldn't have done it otherwise.
And was McCormick stoning you guys? What was going on that you didn't?
McCormick was dying to manage Arthur. He just two things that was kind of cute. Mark became we were very competitive for a number of years. Our two pro serve and IMG were battling everywhere. But Mark and I became good friends privately and. He said, don't ever tell that story about Ash. He said, bringing him to me three times. I brought him four times. And I said, that's the truthful story. But basically, Mark was a little cool at times. And Arthur was introverted, was a little shy. Arthur was actually shy. And he didn't have a warmth. He didn't feel comfortable for whatever reason. I can't tell you exactly why.
Now, is it true that you and Stan and Arthur, you guys never had a contract?
That is the first year we had a 3-page letter. Each of them had the same letter describing what I would do and what their requirements were, and it literally just outlined the history of it and what we're going to do. And you could certainly call that a memo of understanding or a contract. That was over after 1 year, and then we just never renewed it. We just went on a handshake from then on, from with Arthur for 27 years and with Stan for 52.
What was the best deal you ever did for Arthur? I mean, I remember he had head rackets. He had Lecoq Sportif.
Well, the head rackets were probably the best, because when we made the first year, we made the deal with the head rackets. We made an Arthur Ashe head racket, but we also got a 5% royalty on all other head rackets that were coming up in the market then. So the royalties exploded as a result of that.
Was that in perpetuity?
No, it was not. But a few years later, I would say 7 or 8 years later, Head came to me and said, you know, we want to be with Arthur as long as he wants to be in tennis. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, as long as he's involved in tennis, we like to keep his name on our products. And it was sort of a lifetime agreement. And Arthur and I both said, great, we'd love that. And then sadly, Arthur died about 2 years later of AIDS. So he never really got the full fruition of that contract.
What was it like being in that business at that moment in time, you know, in advance of Borg and McEnroe? Like, you guys really were the beginning of it all. What was it like hustling from town to town, city to city, country to country, buzzing all over the place?
Well, it was very exciting. It was thrilling because, first of all, I had great people that I was working with. I mean, Arthur and Stan are unique characters, and also Charlie Passerell was a client, and Jimmy Osborne. I had a lot of American clients when I started. Then I got Europeans right away. I was the first tennis agent anywhere in the world by about 2 or 3 years. So I got a head start on everybody in tennis.
What was it that you did? You negotiated deals.
No, I did everything. I negotiated. First of all, I handled their schedule, which is the most important thing. I negotiated endorsements, which could be racket, shoes, clothing, and then all kind of other commercial endorsements as it developed. But I also handled their exhibitions, their speaking engagements. And it was across the board, full-time agency. We did everything for the people initially.
Are you the originator of the appearance fee?
No, not really. No, Ash and Smith, to their credit, didn't want to take appearance fees. The first person with appearance fee that really started it was Bjorn Borg with McCormick. McCormick got Borg, and Borg was a great player, and he was the first one coming out of Europe, and he was, you know, they started very low at $25,000 and ended up being $100,000 or $200,000 for an appearance fee. And that changed the whole front end of the game, because then everybody had to do it if they had a great player. You could not do it. The first deal I ever made for Stan Smith was with a tournament in Switzerland for, I think it was a $10,000. We made it at Wimbledon. It was a $10,000 or $20,000 appearance fee. And when Stan heard about it, he said, no, I'm not taking the money. Call the promoter and give the money back to him. I don't believe in appearance fees. I want to be paid for – I mean – Stan Smith is too good to be true. And we actually turned down the contract for $20,000.
I was going to ask you later in the show your opinion of appearance fees, but I may as well just ask you now since we're here.
Well, I think appearance fees are bad and good. I mean, I think they hurt the sport ultimately, because if the agents play all kinds of games with them, they exploit. They have their own market there. I mean, you end up with a top 10 player and you give them a certain guarantee sometimes to sign him. And then you go out and pass out all on to appearance fees at the tournaments. For example, in today's ATP world, the 1000 series do not allow for personal guarantees, appearance money. The 500s do, and the 250s do. And to me, it's just a better competition if you put all that money into prize money. I mean, don't lessen the money, increase the money. But the problem with what happens is tournaments want to get better and they compete against one another. So if you're starting a new tournament in Mexico City and you're against the tournament in America, you're going to start paying fees to get the best players. Then the American term has got to turn around and pay fees to compete. And so that's what happens. It just lifts everybody up. And clearly, very quick, I spent a year of my life traveling all over with the ATP, trying to get with the new formula of the 500s, no guarantees for 500, just like the thousands. Let them have guarantees in the 250s. And finally, the ATP ruled. They said, Donald, no problem. We agree with you. We agree. All the tournaments can agree at the 500s not to have any guarantees, but they, the 500s, have to police it. And I said, they're not going to police it. That's absurd. I know, you know, you always know who's going to cheat. The Chinese are going to cheat. The Japanese are going to cheat. Because the Australians, if they can, because there's the distance involved. And, you know,
they got to pay if you're going to, they got to pay if they want players.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, so right now, I mean, I do think that initially, I think it hurts the competition. I wish there was a better doing it. For example, golf gets around it by doing the, you know, the players on the first day do a player
pro-am.
We call pro-am, and they get around that and pay big funds to the run. Or better yet, which I don't think is a problem, if you went to Coca-Cola and said, all right, I'll play 10 events that you select for Coca-Cola, pay me $1 million for those 10, that's fine. That doesn't really hurt your competition, you know, but when you pay a guy $100,000 to show up, here's the problem. What happens when he comes to play and his leg hurts just a little bit? Not bad, but he's got to play.
We always heard a story that Jack Kramer's son got, they paid Andy Murray a fortune. He lost first round and he shut the tournament down, that he was totally.
Well, I don't think that caused the tournament down, but that is a true story that he played and got a guarantee and didn't play very well. But what I was going to say, like one year in Washington, I ran the City Open in Washington 50 years. One year, I lost both Agassi and Sampras in back-to-back matches on the second day, and I was paying them both guarantees. I almost committed suicide as a promoter. I mean, you know, so I think there's a way to do
what
it.
What do you do when that happens? Do you ask them to stick around and sign autographs? Do you ask them to?
No, I didn't ask them to do anything. They move on to the next week. To his credit, Agassi that year had won Wimbledon and just had a binge afterwards celebrating, hadn't trained, hadn't played. And very secretly, he came and said, I'd like to take just half of what you promised me, but I don't want anybody else to know it. And so we never disclosed that. For the first time I ever told that story. We actually, at his suggestion, paid him half the guarantee for appearance money.
Because he was playing shitty tennis.
Well, he didn't play it worth a damn that day. But imagine being the promoter and seeing Agassi and Sampras on your center court get beat back to back by good players. They didn't throw. The players tried. They just didn't win.
Of course. The story of the Stan Smith shoe.
Well, it's a long-term story. I mean, you know, we started with
the. But hang on a second. But the story is that there was never a shoe, such a thing as a shoe deal.
Well, that we were one of the first ones because in 72.
Signature shoe deal.
Yeah, Stan won Wimbledon in 72. And I got a call that summer from Horst Osler, the chairman of Adidas. And he said, Donald, I'm coming into America next year with five different parts of the country. I'm going to have key people and I want to have a named player wearing my shoe. And he said, we have a new shoe. It's a performance shoe. And it's a leather shoe. And it was actually with a French professional named Robert Hayet. And so for the first year, it was called the Hayet Smith shoe. And then they dropped Hayet and Stan started wearing the shoe in competitive matches.
But you guys met Stan. You guys met in a cabaret.
We did at midnight, and Stan. It was a funny story. He told it. You know, I said, Stan, we're going to meet tomorrow. We want to meet Dosser at 12 o'clock tomorrow. And he said, well, I have a match at 2 o'clock. I can't meet him at 12 noon. I said, he doesn't want to meet at 12 noon. He wants to meet at midnight. Horst was a guy who loved to stay up late. He made deals late. That was the way he was. And I got to know him awfully well over the years, and he was, I think, the smartest sports marketer that I ever came in touch with. He was phenomenal.
So the shoe, did they put Stan's face on the tongue?
They put the face on the tongue and his name and Stan Smith on the heel of the show, heel, the green tab. And we made seven contracts over the period of from 72 to 2018. And in 2018, the contracts were up, but they were selling a ton of shoes that year. What they had done, which was really clever on their part, the shoe was being discounted a lot of places in 15. So they came to me and said, to Stan and I together at Wimbledon, said, we'd like to continue our contract for two more years, but go black.
Discontinue the shoe, right.
Not sell one shoe to anybody anywhere. We'll pay you a fee, but it won't be what it was. We'll pay you half of your normal fee, but we won't sell a shoe, but we'll come out in 2018. And we think we can really control the market. And the shoe just took off in 2018. Damn near sold $1 billion in shoes by 2019. And so
you guys are Stan, you guys are Adidas millionaires, bazillionaires. I mean, you have to made a fortune on this deal. This is incredible.
Well, it was a long-term deal. And when they came to us in 18, and let's put it this way, after seven contracts, the eighth contract was in 2018. We started negotiating. It took me 14 months to get the thing done. And then at one point they said, look, we'd like to make this contract, you know, for life, forever. I said, what do you mean forever? I said, you mean in perpetuity? And they said, yeah, we want it to continue as long as Stan is playing, or as long as he's alive, it goes to his estate and families. And as long as they're making a Stan Smith name shoe, or the design is the shoe of Stan Smith, he gets a royalty. And so it's in perpetuity.
How do you guys do they actually mail you a check, or they wire the money? How do you get paid?
No. We get a sales statement every year, you know, twice a year. They tell us what they're selling and what the royalty is. And so
someone told me that Stan gets $1 a pair. Is that true?
I can't comment on that one way or the other.
What is the next greatest deal? Would it be fair to say that's the greatest deal you ever did?
Well, there was a little shoe called Michael Jordan, Air Jordan, which wasn't a bad deal.
So let's just start. So you're the first tennis agent. You guys did all this special stuff. How did ProServe become prominent, and how did you sign Michael Jordan?
Well, it's an interesting story. We in 72, 73, Arthur was giving a speech at a women's democratic club in Washington, luncheon. And there were about 400 women, and there were three men in the room. One was Arthur, myself, and his father, Arthur Sr. And Arthur opened the speech, unbeknownst to me, and said, I'm here today with two people that I would trust with my life, my father and my good friend, Donald Dell. And a lady in the audience was named Mrs. Collis Jones. And Collis Jones was an All-American basketball player at Notre Dame. She called me the next day after that speech and said, can I get a copy of Arthur's speech? I said, sure. And she called the high school here in Washington, St. John's High School coach, a guy named Joe Gallagher, and said, you know, do you know anything about Donald Dell? And, you know, he's in tennis, but I'd like to maybe have him come and represent my son in basketball. And Collis was drafted in the first round by the Milwaukee Bucks, but they were drafted in 16 that year because they had won the championship with Kareem. So there were two leagues. It was ABA, and they had Dallas on the ABA that drafted him, and on the other side, Milwaukee. And so we negotiated with both sides. He was my first client. We did very well by him because we had two leagues, and that led us getting into basketball more and more. After about 3 years of being in basketball, about 1976, 77, I thought of the idea. My older brother had gone to North Carolina and had played on the tennis team there. And
that's Dickie?
Dean Smith. No, my older brother was named Peter.
I'm sorry.
I have a younger brother named Dick.
Sorry.
My older brother was a very good tennis player, played basketball and freshman basketball at Carolina, and was very much involved in basketball down there. And I always had a love of Carolina because of that. And so I went down to visit Coach Dean Smith, and I said, Coach, I'd like to propose something. Actually, I did it on the phone first, and then I went down to see him about it. But I said, look, I'd like to propose ProServe will not recruit any of your players. We won't call them. We won't write them. You're not going to be worried about agents buzzing your program and all that's nonsense. If on the condition that at the end of the year, you pick a player you want us to meet, but we meet him in your office and we meet him with his parents or with you. You don't have to. And he said, well, I can't just give every player to you. I said, I understand that. He said, I'm going to pick other agents. I said, that's fine. So a long story short, the first one I went down to see the first time, and he asked me to see Dennis Wysick, who was captain of the team that year, and another player named Bob McAdoo. Huh. Wysick was an average player. McAdoo ended up playing in the pros for 15 years.
Hall of Famer, yeah. I believe. Yeah,
he is a Hall of Famer. And yeah. I had an hour and a half with each one of them. And so afterwards, Dean brought me into his office and said, well, what do you think, Donald? What's your feeling? I said, well, I'd love to represent both of them. I said, Dennis, we would, he's the captain. That'd be an honor. I said, Bob McAdoo's probably already signed with somebody. He had no interest. Dean banged the table with his hand and said, nobody's ever signed in my program. What are you talking about? I said, Coach, you know, I've done this about 3 or 4 years recruiting. And I said, he was looking at the ceiling out the window. The only reason he was talking to me was out of courtesy for you. I don't know if he signed for sure, but I think he has. And Dean got very upset. I flew home that night from Chapel Hill. I got home about 9 o'clock, about 10:30. I get a phone call from Coach Smith out of the blue. He says, Donald, damn it, you were right. He signed with Earl Foreman of the Virginia Squires in the old ABA league. But damn it, I'm going to get that contract and rip it up. And I said, good luck, Coach. It's about 2 weeks later. Dean calls me, said, I got the contract back. It's ripped up. He, you know, because he would have lost every game that McAdoo had played as a pro. And because under these stupid NCAA rules, you can't sign anything like that. And you're immediately a pro.
Oh, well, he would have been in violation.
Yeah.
Of he would have.
So then I said, this is the real kicker. So then I said to Dean, God, well, that's great. I'd love to represent McAdoo. He said, No, you're too close to it. I'm giving McAdoo to Billy Madden, who's a guy who's a good friend of mine from Yale, who's a basketball player at Yale. I said, you're doing what? He said, no. He said, don't worry. Your time will come. For the next 14 years, I get every player that mattered out of Carolina.
Really?
Yeah. That's what really established. And were really strong in the ACC.
And Dean Smith handed you Michael Jordan?
Yeah, what happened with Coach Smith, which is amazing, I got a phone call about 10 a.m. one Saturday morning, which was kind of unusual. Saturday morning, my phone rings, and Coach says to me, this is right after they had won the national championship, 63. And he says, 1983. He says to me, Donald, how do you feel about representing Michael Jordan? And I said, well, God, I'd love to, but he's a junior. And he said, no, but I think he should come out. And I just wonder what you thought about it. And he said, by the way, I've got Michael here in my office with his mother, Dolores. Would you like to speak to both of them? I said, sure. So I got on the phone and I said, Michael, Coach Smith is talking about, you know, maybe coming out and that I might represent you. How do you feel about that? And he said, well, I don't really want to come out. He said, you know, I want to finish here at Chapel Hill. I love Carolina. But the coach says that I should really leave. And then Dolores got on the phone and we talked a little bit. And then they came up to see me just before the draft was, you know, by that time it was sort of a done deal verbally that we were going to represent Michael. But to answer your question, that was a phone call from Dean Smith.
And the Nike deal?
Well, the Nike deal, you know, at Carolina, Michael had always worn Converse shoes at Carolina. The team did. And so Adidas and Nike were both really competing terrifically head to head, trying to get Michael when he came out of college. And we had deals with both of them, talking to both of them. And we wanted, a Michael Jordan named shoe on the name, just like Stan Smith on the shoe itself, which is hard to do. They always want to put, you know, on a hang tag or something, which then they can tear off the hang tag. The shoe doesn't mean anything because it's not tied to the name. And they sent two people, Rob Strasser and Peter Moore. This is Nike. They were coming into Washington. They were opening a big Nike store in Georgetown on a Friday night. And Strasser and Peter Moore called me and said, we'd like to meet with you in your office. on Friday or Saturday. I said, well, how about Saturday morning? So they came in Saturday morning after this big party opening the new Nike store in Georgetown. And we were sitting there, and you know, for the first hour, we were arguing. We wanted, a Michael Jordan shoe. They were arguing they wanted a Nike shoe. And suddenly, out of the blue, Peter Moore says, well, what about something like Air Jordan? And it just sort of popped out of his mouth, you know. and everybody just was stunned. And sort of, you know, we looked and thought, God, Air Jordan, that's a hell of a great idea. And Peter Moore once told me a story. I don't know if it's accurate. He said, I always asked, I said, where did you come up with that idea of Air Jordan? And he said, years and years ago, he said, I was watching a basketball game between North Carolina and North Carolina State at Raleigh. And some guy held up a sign in the audience saying Air Jordan.
Really?
And he said, I never forgot that. But that's where the name Air Jordan. I don't care what anybody else tells you. All these other guys tell you these stories. Air Jordan popped out of his mouth on a Saturday morning in my office in Washington, D.C., and the rest is history.
The more lucrative deal?
What happened was in the first year, we made a 5-year deal for Jordan. And after that was an endorsement deal. And about the third year of that, we were talking with Phil Knight of Nike, and we were arguing back and forth, and we persuaded Phil to do something quiet, just have a name shoe, one pot at 5% on a name royalty, but quietly over here, this other little bucket for a 3% on the basketball shoes that were coming up. They were starting to get really aggressive in basketball, and basketball took off. And now Nike did that. A lot of people think Michael Jordan did that. I think Nike did that with their advertising and their publicity and their marketing they were very smart marketers. And so the royalty in the bucket of 3% got awfully strong, awfully fast. And I think,
wait, so you guys were taking 3% of all the basketball shoes
and we were getting 5% on the Jordan. And then that developed into where that, when that contract was over, Phil decided that he came up with the idea of a new company. Now at that stage, to be correct with you, I was no longer representing Michael after 10 years. Michael left me after 10 years. My assistant, David Falk, who worked for me for 8 years as my assistant and 10 years at 18 years in the company, stole Michael from me, if the truth be known. And he made a new deal where I think, well, I know what the deal was because I had the right to have the contract and so forth in our settlement. And they made a new deal where Michael had a company called Jump Inc. And he basically is partners with Nike. I didn't negotiate that deal. I didn't have anything to do with that deal, but that's a hell of a long-term deal. And that's, the Jump Inc. is now a $2 billion sales company, wholly owned by Nike as a subsidiary. But Michael's the president, and Nike does all the work, picks the advertising, the market. I don't know how involved Michael is, but he certainly is clipping coupons every year out of that deal.
David Falk stole your player. That seems to be de rigueur in the game these days, in the agent game, where the junior agent ingratiates himself to the player, and then they jump ship, and the junior agent takes a smaller piece. So ProServe was bought, then bought, right? ProServe is essentially now, it went to one group, and then that group sold it to Octagon.
No. ProServe was went to
Advantage. Sorry.
No. ProServe went to SFX. Bob Silliman bought ProServe. But just prior to selling, I mean, 4 or 5 years before that, two of my partners had left to start a competitive agency called Advantage. And Advantage was a competing agency to ProServe and IMG. There were three of us. And Advantage was bought by Octagon, and that's where Octagon got into it with Advantage. The three major companies were Octagon, ProServe, and IMG. We sold to SFX, and then a guy in Louisville named Bob Best bought our company called Best, Blue, Jonathan Blue, I'm sorry, was his name, in Louisville, Kentucky, bought from the remnants of ProServe from SFX. And that's, and then that went, was bought by LaGuardia. I've stayed on with different pieces of the company, but ProServe is not a factor as such today. It's been diluted.
And you continued on. You were the owner of the DC tournament.
No, I was never the owner. I started and founded the tournament, but I gave the tournament in 1972 to the Washington Tennis and Education Foundation, and gave them that and ran it for them every year thereafter. And then they sold it to Mark Ein about 2 years ago, and they made a lot of money out of the tournament. But I gave them the sanction. I gave them the tournament because they had supported me financially when I was a young kid in the juniors.
How would you describe your life in tennis now that the book, you know, to some degree has been written?
Well, I think it was a thrilling, fun ride. I think it was exciting and certainly learned a ton about a lot of different things. And the happiest moments I had in tennis really were the Davis Cup years in 68, 69. Those were the most exciting, exhilarating, fun years. We were, you know, I was with five great guys that I was their captain, and we traveled everywhere, literally all over the world for 2 years, never lost a match. And then I retired from that and started a new business, which proved to be very successful. And so I'm very thankful. I think I've been very fortunate. The timing, you know, I became Davis Cup captain when the game went open in 68. That's just timing. You know, I had great clients in Arthur Ashe and Stan Smith, and I was very lucky to get Michael Jordan. These were lucky events, and timing's everything.
We didn't even mention the fact that you were a broadcaster at all the tournaments for years and years.
Yeah, Bud Collins and I we did Wimbledon for 5 years. We did the U.S. Open and the French. Bud was a great guy and wonderful commentator. He was with the Boston Globe as a writer and a dear friend.
Bud Collins, the straw that stirred the drink, one of the great cheerleaders and journalists in the history of the sport. And you worked with Bud closely.
For 5 years, I did you know, 20 shows a year with Bud, and Dick Enberg. We worked Wimbledon with Dick Enberg. I mean, I worked with a lot of different people, but Bud was the staple. We did PBS. You know, we actually started before it was in football. We started Monday Night Tennis, if you can believe that. I got all seven of those tournaments between Wimbledon and the U.S. Open. I got the seven tournaments to agree to play their finals on Monday. So if each one would play it on Monday, then the tournaments would all start on Tuesday of the following week. Now that took a Herculean effort to get them to all agree to that. And the price of agreeing to that was I promised them national television on PBS. The only problem with that was I had to sell all the sponsors on PBS. It was WGBH in Boston.
Wait, so you did a time buy with the major tennis, with the finals?
Right. For the whole week, we did the whole tournament. We did Monday night. We did our finals on Monday night, but we normally covered about the quarters on from, you know, like Saturday, Sunday and Monday was PBS tennis, WGBH Boston Channel 2. And Bud Collins and I did the commentary.
And were you so powerful that you forced your way in, or did somebody say, hey, you know, you should broadcast this? You should be the broadcaster. Bud, you have a nice voice.
No, Bud was the one who gave me the first chance to as Davis Cup captain. He had me on his show a number of times.
Okay.
Where my strength was, I was bringing the money. I made the sale to that's what really made it happen. Because in those days, to sell PBS on national television to a sponsor was not easy. Because you didn't get any, you had no commercials. You only had 10 seconds.
So you and Julia Child were going up head to head against each other.
We had a lot of fun. We really did.
Did you enjoy broadcasting?
I love broadcasting. Yeah, it's an ego trip, no question about that. But with Bud, it was fun because he never stopped talking. And so I would jump in and he would make me look good because he in some ways overtalked some, but he was a character. You had to know him, you know. Bud came up, for example, one of the things we were doing on PBS, he came with a thing called a guy named Fingers Fortescue. that he was a person on the let court, net, put his finger on the let court. There was no such person like that. We used to get phone calls, letters, calls saying, where does Fingers live? What? How old is Fingers? What does he look like? I mean, it was, and the Bud just made it up.
You know, we grew up in Rhode Island, and Bud was all over New England championing tennis, and we knew him, and he was really a special,
special. He was a great cheerleader for tennis.
He was incredible, and his writing and his descriptive talk of the players and the nicknames he gave them and everything he did was very, very special. I'm glad that I asked you about that and that we mentioned him.
No, he was something. He was a great hidden asset for the sport of pro tennis, always.
You and your people, Charlie and Stan and Arthur, did a lot of special things. You came out on the right side of history with regards to human rights, with regards to traveling to South Africa, with regards to boycotting Wimbledon and creating the ATP. How did you guys operate and how were you able to find, you know, your stances?
What do you mean by the question about your stances?
You guys seem to always sort of, why do you erred on the side of truth and justice. We don't see that as often these days, unfortunately.
You got to understand, go back and start at the basics. I mean, you're working with two athletes. You're on a handshake all over the world. So there's got to be a lot of trust and relationships and love between you and those people. And that makes it all possible. If you trust somebody like that, you're going to have a career on a handshake. Imagine having a handshake with Stan Smith today after 52 years. I mean, that's pretty phenomenal. And it's because of the character of his personality, the way he is. So when you say took stances, we all had different opinions, but we tried to do what we thought was right. And we, in many cases, we were for open tennis. We were against apartheid, obviously. Arthur had a lot of causes. Charlie was Puerto Rican. You know, we had a really, I used to give a clinic when I was running the Davis Cup team. I'd give a clinic every Monday in the city where we were. And I used to talk about the ghetto of the country club. And it used to shake up people. I'd go in an audience and talk at lunch or something. And I talk about the ghetto of the country club. Think about it. There's a country club ghetto, like similarity. It's just in a different form.
Does the country club culture grate on you? Do you find this does it remain problematic for the sport?
No, I think it's gotten a little bit better. You got to remember my background. In 1968, I ran five states for Bobby Kennedy when he was running for president in 1968. I was the lead advance for him in five states. So I was very much much more liberal in that sense. And Arthur certainly was, and Charlie certainly was. I mean, everybody's different, but I had a strong background in politics. If Bobby Kennedy had lived and became president, I would probably never have gotten into sports. I was going to go work in the White House on his staff for 2 years. That was my handshake with him. And then he was going to come out to Potomac and give two dinners and try to raise enough money for me to run for Congress. That's what I had always dreamed about doing. And thank God I never did it. But it was only because he was assassinated that changed my whole plans.
Were you with him when he was shot?
Well, he was at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. California was one of my stops. I was actually with the Davis Cup team in Charlotte. We were playing a Davis Cup match down there against Ecuador. So we had just left California on Sunday, and the primary was Tuesday. On Sunday, we had Arthur Ashe and Stan Smith on the back of a train with Bobby Kennedy. And in the inner city, Arthur would introduce him, and out in the countryside, Stan Smith would introduce him. And they were running back and forth for the whole day. And on a Sunday, we flew to Charlotte Sunday night, and Tuesday night he was killed. And that was one hell of a shock, sitting there watching that whole thing on television.
Would he have been president?
I believe he would have been president if he had lived, yes. He only had to be, what's his name, the vice president, and then he would have faced Nixon. Johnson's vice president was the guy from Wisconsin, from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Agnew?
No, Agnew was from Maryland. He was Republican. No, Democrat. He was the vice president under Lyndon Johnson. Johnson withdrew that he wasn't running, and we had to run against Hubert Humphrey was his name. Hubert, no, was it Hubert Humphrey? From Minnesota. He was the vice president. Vice President Humphrey. And he ended up losing the election very close to Richard Nixon in 68. I think Bobby Kennedy would have beaten Richard Kennedy very easily. I mean, Richard Nixon very easily.
Let's move into the fourth set. This is the 10 ball scramble. I just say something, you say what comes into your mind. We go quick, okay?
Okay. Yeah.
Role of the agent.
Honesty.
What makes a good agent?
Tireless worker.
What makes a bad agent?
Untruthful and exaggerating.
IMG.
Awfully good was the pathfinder in sports.
Octagon.
Very good and very strong in women's tennis.
Pro serve.
We were there when it all started and great run.
Team 8.
New and different.
The ATP.
Getting stronger and better.
The WTA.
Growing up fast.
The ITF.
Hopeless and lost.
Why?
Because they don't represent anything.
Your best moment in tennis.
Winning the Davis Cup in 68 against Harry Hopman and the Australians.
Your best moment in life.
Getting married to Carol Dell and having two great clients in Arthur and Stan.
Let's move into the fifth and final set. This is the king of the court. If you could be the king of tennis and make any change you wanted in the sport with just a swing of the racket, no aggravation, what would it be?
I might come up with the idea of a joint czar of the sport, three different people, one for America, one for Asia, one for Europe. But they'd have to be really knowledgeable Jack Cramer type people that would work together for the betterment of the sport.
A triumvirate of presidents.
Really knowledgeable, and trusting. They would be czar in that particular area of where they were. They'd run the sport, pro sport.
I feel like I could talk to you for another 10 hours. This has just been really a master class in the history of pro tennis, and I think that for a lot of my listeners, we have a lot of insight. They enjoy the inside chatter, and this was very enlightening. What happens to you next?
Well,
Do you ride out the holidays, and then are you still doing deals week in and
no,
week out, or?
I'm still working for a Sport 5, which is a company in New York, and I'm more involved in television, some of their endorsements and marketing and sales. I work with divisional heads in that company,
Sport
and I'll
5 is
talk
a
to.
division of Lagardère, correct?
No, Sport 5 bought Lagardère. They own Lagardère.
Okay.
Bought all their assets.
And that's what you're doing. You're still
Well, I'm still going pretty strong. I'm quiet. I'm going to do it for maybe another year or so, and that'll be plenty.
Man, you remind me of Bob Arum, the boxing promoter. You guys just don't stop. Week in and week out, you're just in it.
Well, that's what keeps life going. I mean, if you like what you do and you're working with nice people, why wouldn't you continue? That's what always fascinates me. People say, "Why are you still working?" I say, "Well, I like very much what I do, and I like the people I'm working with."
Now, do I have it right that your nickname was Donald Deal, or does just some people called you that?
Well, no, the guy who gave me the name was Bud Collins,
Oh, it was
and
Bud. Okay.
ironically, and Bud was in the wedding. Ironically, I married a woman named Carol Oshie, and if you can believe it, she was from Deal, New Jersey. And so Bud Collins leaped on that and said, "Well, Donald Deal, that's a perfect nickname."
Amazing. Listen, I can't thank you enough. Enjoy the holidays. Look forward to maybe seeing and talking with you down the road.
A lot of fun. I've enjoyed it. I appreciate it. If when you get your final show, I'd like to get a copy of it, at least see it.
My man, you will have the show. Donald Dell, what a pleasure. You are released.
Okay. Thanks, Greg. Lots of fun. I enjoyed it.
Huge thank you to Donald Dell, and thank you to Sergio Tacchini. See them at sergiotacchini.com. Diadora is the official shoe of the podcast. See them at diadora.com, and be on the lookout for more to come. Max Loeb edited the show. Our music is by Brian Senti. We'll be back next time with more of the most interesting voices in the sport. Until then, I'm Craig Shapiro, and you are released.